Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Richard Forty. He spent his working life in paleontology at the Natural History Museum, specializing in trilobites. He was elected president of the Geological Society of London in 2007 and is a fellow of the Royal Society and of the Royal Society of Literature. And we're talking about his latest book, A Curious Boy, The Making of a Scientist. Richard, welcome back to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book, A Curious Boy. This is a book that does something I think no other book I have ever read does, and that details the very odd, meandering, complicated path by which a curious child, yourself, becomes a scientist. It's not linear at all.
Well, I suppose a lot of people have a rather curious impression, to use the word curious again, that scientists are kind of born scientists and make their way in a straight line to becoming...
It's not a straight line, as people imagine. Like, people, I think, you know, I played with the chemistry set when I was a kid. I'm going to become a chemist when I'm an adult. And as you point out in that book, that doesn't happen.
I think possibly only mathematicians are born mathematicians and stay mathematicians. I don't mean to cause any offense to any mathematicians who may be listening.
Richard, I've interviewed those mathematicians, and you're right.
I think maths and music go together, don't they?
Yeah.
The wiring. And I think it's probably also true of musicians. They discover a talent very early on, and that's what they turn into.
Go ahead.
As somebody who is generally curious, as I was and indeed still am, it's a much less simple story.
It is amazing, because I got the feeling reading it, without a couple of interactions or proper teachers or certain things, you describe it as luck and twists of fate, you could have ended up a mycologist. You could have ended up any one of a number of things instead of a paleontologist.
That's quite correct. We had in our curious odd system of education here, you had to divide yourself into a science strain or an art strain quite early on. And I was equally adept at both, incompetent at both, if you prefer. But anyway, my life was decided by a headmaster who really knew what was best for everybody, who asked me a simple question. He called me aside one day and said, 40, are you more interested in people or things? And for one second I hesitated, and for some reason, I don't know why, I said things. And he said, well, you're a scientist. And really, that determined the direction I took, at least professionally, for many years. But of course, I wanted to be a writer. Some other part of me wanted to be a writer. And I was only able to marry those two halves of my personality together again when I was when I could see middle age approaching.
It is interesting, though. I mean, we have interviewed several times before, and I've read your other books, but I never would have pictured you as a potential artist, whether it's a literary artist. You wrote poetry too, and that was an important, passionate part of your life as you grew up.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I think when I was at school, I felt I needed to study science. For one reason, which is it was technical and you needed to get on top of it and rather specialized. But I could do the literature stuff all by myself, you know. I could read books. I could parse poetry. I was listened in my intellectual phase, which I described rather carefully in the middle of the book. I used to listen to a very, very intellectual radio program that did things like premiere Dylan Thomas's Under Milk Wood and the Theatre of the Absurd. And I thought at that time I could take it all in, you know. The ambition of youth is that your mind is like a sponge that can absorb everything. Of course, it's a total fabrication, and you discover later on that you can't take it all in. But while you're young and foolish, you think you can.
But all of that actually has played a part into the person that you are today, because your ability to write, your ability to convey all the things that happened to you in the past, is due in part because of that phase that you went through.
Oh, absolutely, yes, I'm sure that's right. It possibly allows me to what would you say, keep a, I won't say a common touch, but I can communicate with more people than can many scientists who have taken their own solitary road for so long that their idea of communicating is very often to sort of write a scientific paper without jokes. I'm sure you probably come across such books. I name no examples.
I know, and I am very familiar with those. But in the end, you do cite luck and twists of fate that ultimately brought you from point A to point Z. And to a lot of people, that may sound like, come on, you know.
No, absolutely right. Fate, if you like, intervened in my story several times to my advantage. I mean, I describe an expedition I joined from the University of Cambridge to the Arctic island of Svalbard, or islands of Svalbard. Now, that was luck, because on that trip, the expedition discovered rocks that had never been found before, but are absolutely full of wonderful fossils. Including trilobites, which I'd been in love with for a very long time. Now, how's that for luck? and then my professor at Cambridge was, it turns out, the world authority on, of all things, trilobites. So I had a PhD, as it were, land in my lap, and I had the right person to steer me through it. Now, if that isn't luck, I don't know what is. So there are certain musings in my book about the different parts that luck, indeed bad luck sometimes, have to play in your life. The danger is, of course, that you undersell any virtues of your own, and people might well agree with you that your life was just down to a matter of luck, lucky chances. That's partly true, but as I think I say somewhere else, it is important also to know what to do with that luck.
It is.
And that if I claim any measure of virtue, that's what it is. I knew what to do with the luck when it came along.
One of the many, I think, wonderful things about this book is there's a symbol for every chapter, a physical object. The book begins with a mounted trout and ends with a broken outhouse in Henlopen Strait, Spitsbergen. And I'm not going to give the audience is going to have to pick up the book to find out how that all sort of works together.
Well, as I speak to you, I'm actually looking at the trout with which the book begins.
Well, so look,
it is sitting behind me in my study.
Well, let's talk about the trout. I don't want to give away a lot of your book, but let's talk about the trout, because that was your earliest days, and it has a lot to do with your father, and that's a complex part of your life.
Well, my father was a superb sports fisherman. You know, he could conjure fish out of rivers in a most magical way, fly fishing. This trout was one of his star catches in 1947 when I was one. From a small river quite near London, where such big fish would not survive today. And I'm told it's the record still for that river.
Wow.
But, of course, a lot of my childhood was spent tagging along behind my father as he did his fishing. And I started looking at beetles and flowers and grasses and everything else in the natural world. So he led me. He was a good naturalist himself. He led me in that direction. And I had a very countryside, despite being a Londoner, we had a very countryside upbringing where there was plenty of opportunity to grab the different aspects of natural history. So I became a naturalist really on a riverbank.
It's fascinating in this book, too, because you revisit some of the areas from your childhood. And there is a sense of loss of the natural world that is a sort of a subtext of your book, like going back and revisiting the streams and the places as a child. It's completely changed.
Yes, that of course, it's anybody of my age writing about the past will say there were more species then, there were more insects then.
That's right.
There were more birds singing then. And I'm afraid it is true. I think it is objectively true because of what we're doing to the environment right now. There was a time when people thought that it was just a sentimental old fool looking back to the glorious days of the past. But now we really know that the world is becoming less rich and less biodiverse. And, of course, as it comes so, the kids who might have become natural historians don't get to sample as much richness as they did when I was a kid.
You know, it's the same for my childhood. You know, I grew up off the banks of the Charles River in Watertown. And if you had some kind of natural places to go to and not any other distractions, that's where you spent your time. And that's where you started maybe collecting things. But today, there's very few places, unless you travel by car, for kids to go to.
Yes, I guess that's true. I mean, is that Watertown, Maine?
No, Watertown, Massachusetts.
Right.
And it had the mighty Charles, which was very polluted at the time. But still, we had herring runs and smelt runs. And those I got to see the last of those. But I also didn't have the internet to distract me. So, you know, you had to do something as a kid, so you went outside.
Yes, that's right. I describe a little bit in the book how boredom, almost,
yeah,
or idleness, was actually a stimulant to going out and making your own entertainment and getting your own knowledge. Now you've got the infinite distractions of the internet. You can have amusing games brought to you perpetually, and you don't have to go and root around in the natural world, which, of course, is, I will think, as human beings, curious human beings, that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Now, you started collecting very, very young, and I want to go through some of your collections and your collection phases. You collected eggs for a brief period.
Yeah, by way of a confession, of course. When I was young, I inherited my father's bird's egg collection, and I added to it. There was a feeling at the time that the activities of small boy collectors was responsible for the decline in the birds. And I think it is probably quite true to say that that was not true. It's the important stuff is environmental change, and change in foodstuffs and farming practices and so on. And the activities of one or two small boys is probably irrelevant. But of course, once I was shocked out of it and made to feel guilty, I never touched egg collecting again. And nobody does it now, and probably quite rightly so.
You also collected butterflies, which is something I did as a kid.
That was very brief.
Yeah, and mine was brief too, and I think for the same reason.
The process of killing the butterflies.
No, it was not good.
Was not good. And the process of pinning them out was technically difficult. So that wasn't one that lasted. And so when I move on to fossils, of course, you're doing no harm to anybody.
I know.
And they don't wiggle about and try and get away from you either. So that was something that stayed with me.
You also developed a passion for chemistry. I found that chapter the strangest chapter, boy chemist. Richard Forty, boy chemist. How did that start?
A chemistry set, which in those days, the chemicals were, well, I don't know if it's true in the States. We have something called health and safety legislation here, which means that lots of chemicals are out of bounds. But then a chemistry set was rather more exciting. So I started with a boyhood chemistry set, and then I was given a book, which was about chemistry experiments you could do at home. And then I befriended a dispensing chemist who had all sorts of exciting chemicals behind the scenes. And I think he rather took to me because, you know, I could give him one small coin and he would come out with a packet of something that was highly illegal, which I could then mix. I knew the chemical elements pretty well, not as well as Oliver Sacks, whose book, Uncle Tungsten, you might recall.
Yeah.
But I did know my way around the periodic table pretty well. But then, like many small boys, I really, really was challenged to, you know, the stinks and bangs department. I did achieve the apotheosis of the stink by my own rather curious means, which was a chemical called ethyl mercaptan, which smells of sort of skunks and rotting cabbage and all the bad things all rolled into one. And I actually managed to synthesize it in my garden shed laboratory when I was surprisingly young and still naughty enough to kind of experiment on by taking it off to school. And, if I'd been found out, I'd have been probably expelled. But I was cunning enough to keep it secret who was the perpetrator of this ghastly stink. I could have become a chemist. That was certainly on the cards at one time, possibly before I discovered fossils and geology.
Throughout the book, especially when you were young, you talk about the importance of different guides that you had access to. And I just want to address that, that these books that are available to young people, in the case of chemistry, is I think you had Arthur Mee's Children's Encyclopedia.
I had a couple of encyclopedias.
But you also had all sorts of like Collins Pocket Guides and the Observer's Book.
On my shelf even now, I think I one of my chapters on flowers, I think.
Yep.
I said that I had a Collins Pocket Guide, which I still have. And when I see a British flower, this is, if I haven't seen before, I still take down this old book, which I can see behind me now, and sort of tick it off. I don't know. In some funny way, I feel as long as I continue to tick off the flowers, I'm immortal.
There's always one more flower to see.
Yes, as long as there's one more flower to find and tick off on the list. I'm delusional enough to vaguely believe this anyway. But those guides were terribly important. And now, of course, with the resources, as you mentioned, online, the means of identification are so much better these days. You can look up a particular species on Google or something and have lots and lots of images flash before your eyes in a few seconds. Of course, it has to be said that they're not always correct images.
That's right. That's right.
When I get really into something, as I did into fungi, for example, later on, I realize that about after the first five images, which are usually pretty good, you start getting the errors. So the online world is not error-free, but boy, it makes things easier.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Richard Forty. He has spent his working life in paleontology at the Natural History Museum, specializing in trilobites. He was elected president of the Geological Society of London in 2007 and is a fellow of the Royal Society and of the Royal Society of Literature. And we're talking about his latest book. It is really an interesting read, A Curious Boy, The Making of a Scientist. Speaking of fungi, reading that chapter, I really got the feeling like you could have easily become a mycologist.
Yeah, that really was a possibility. That was another fork in the road. Perhaps if I hadn't gone to Svalbard and found those fossils,
yeah,
I might have taken that fault.
Well, that passion is still with you today, though.
Oh yes, I have in my house here. I have a laboratory at home upstairs with quite a good microscope and a lot of books, always books. I preside. One of my less well-known distinctions is I've been president of the Fungus Survey of Oxfordshire, my home county in England, for about 15 or 20 years. So I spend quite a lot of time out there looking for fungi. The wonderful thing about both fossils and fungi, the two Fs, is there's a strong element of serendipity about it.
Yes.
You know, just as you can go to a rock outcrop and bash the rocks with your geological hammer and not know what is going to be revealed, and sometimes it's something wonderful and new, so you can go into the woods, particularly in the fall in the UK, and you will see a fungus there, quite a big one, maybe a 6 inches across, that you've never seen before in your life, because fungi are extraordinarily irregular in their appearance, some of them, and some of them are really, really rare.
And you discovered a new species.
Yes, I've named many, many trilobites, but I do have the one fungus to my credit. Not the most spectacular fungus, it has to be said. It shows up as a bright orange patch on fallen herbs. But never mind, it's my own, and I found it not more than half a mile from where I'm talking now.
Wow.
So the great thing is, you know, you don't have to go to Svalbard or the tropical rainforest to make new discoveries. You can do it in your own backyard if you know what to look for.
People would probably be surprised that the first fossil that shows up in the book as sort of the symbol for that chapter, is not a trilobite. It's a Jurassic ammonite.
It is indeed. And again, I got that to hand as I speak to you now. Because, yes, I found this, was I 9 or 10, as a very young boy.
Wow.
Of course, England has the famed Jurassic Coast along its southern shores, which is where you get one of the best successions of Jurassic strata anywhere in the world. And we were staying in a caravan holiday, nothing very luxurious, when this ammonite turned up from a nearby golf course where they'd scraped some rock to stop it falling down over the cliff edge. So I brought it back with me, and it's never left me, except I dropped it once, and it split in two, but it now fits together in two halves. So, yes, that was the thing that suddenly switched that particular switch.
Huh.
And after that, there was no holding me back. I was went out and made yet another collection.
Well, you started with had fossil sea urchins, which are beautiful.
Indeed. They're lovely. They're very beautiful things, and they come from the chalk, which is a soft Cretaceous formation, which surrounds me where I live now in a small town in west of London. So I still go out and occasionally get lucky and pick up a sea urchin and bring it home.
One of those moments when reading this book where I really identified with you, when you talked about your first exposure to dinosaurs, was courtesy of Walt Disney.
Oh, yes. Yes, Fantasia.
Yep.
Was it yours too?
Yes.
Yes. Well, of course, it is also an interesting reflection on the movement of scientific thought. Because an awful lot of what Disney portrayed in that film, which was the first really serious animation of dinosaurs, a lot of it has now been scientifically disproved. For example, you remember the Brachiosaurus or the Brontosauruses, the great big lumbering creatures.
Right.
But they were shown wallowing around in swamps. You might remember.
I remember it clearly.
But of course, now they're thought of rather as elephants wandering in herds.
Yep.
Herds over dry land. So ideas of how they lived have more or less completely changed. And of course, Disney had the world turning into a desert, didn't he, at the end, so that all the dinosaurs kind of died of thirst.
As opposed to an asteroid hitting the planet.
Now we have an asteroid coming in and doing the same job. He would have loved that. That would have been more dramatic.
Oh, would have been. It would have been great.
Wonderful. That was the set to the Rite of Spring, wasn't it?
Music
was the Rite of Spring. He could have made really something of that meteorite. incidentally, as you know, the Disney Corporation are extremely sensitive about the use of any of their images.
Oh, I know.
So, I was never allowed to use an image from Fantasia.
Oh, my God, no. Oh, no.
We know better now. that just wasn't on.
So how did it end up being trilobites? I find ammonites particularly engaging. But what is it about trilobites that even the non-paleontologist, the person who doesn't know anything, doesn't know the name Ordovician? What is it? Trilobites are really attractive.
They're extraordinarily varied. That's the thing. There are some that are spiny as pincushions. You know, some are giants, almost a yard long. They have eyes. That's also, you know, they've got a complex visual system. They're one of the first creatures that you can actually see, could see the world. And in fact, one of my earlier books was called Trilobite Eyewitness to Evolution, because I had this idea that they were looking out on the world even as it became biologically complex. So I think it's the variety, the complexity, and the sheer weirdness of some of them. I mean, there's a trilobite which I was involved with, or still am involved with, which carries a trident on the front of its head. Now, it looks completely implausible. In fact, when I first saw this, I thought must be a fake. It came from Morocco, where people were quite adept at making fake trilobites. So I thought I was being had, you know, by a Moroccan faker. But then when the more turned up, it was obviously a real thing. And I'm still puzzling out what that trident could have done when the animal was alive. So there are challenges to understanding the trilobites as well. And because they're so exotic, I think that merely makes an attraction for, at least for invertebrates.
I also like the fact that...
We'll never win against the dinosaurs.
Yeah, you're right. But for an invertebrate, they're up there.
I think so, yes.
I like the fact that they can roll up.
Ammonites are wonderful and symmetrical and all the rest of it, but they're not so complex and varied as trilobites.
And trilobites can roll up like a pill bug.
And some trilobites could roll up, some were probably well-streamlined swimmers, and others were bottom crawlers, and, you know, they radiate into all sorts of ecological niches, at least under the sea. Sadly, they didn't survive.
We're almost out of time, and there's so much more in this book that people need to really pick it up and read. But I also found it interesting that you got involved in philosophy and Zen for a while, and I have to imagine that helped you out later on.
Well, I did. I had the option at my university, Cambridge. That was a very good system. You could take up a subject for a year and not necessarily pursue it for 3 years. And I became interested in the philosophy of science and I did a course in the history and philosophy of science with some quite notable philosophers. And it was that kind of philosophical reasoning, if you like, which helped me greatly when it came to being a writer.
Yep.
You know, I could understand the issues of knowledge better than if I'd never taken that course and been, as it were, a pure scientist. So it was one of the most valuable things that I ever did, although at the time I did it merely as yet another diversion.
This is a very diverting book. My guest tonight is Richard Forty. He spent his working life in paleontology at the Natural History Museum, specializing in trilobites. He was elected president of the Geological Society of London in 2007 and is a fellow of the Royal Society and of the Royal Society of Literature. We've been talking about his latest book, A Curious Boy, The Making of a Scientist. Richard, it's been a pleasure as always.
Well, thank you so much for interviewing me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.